busy.
While that's loading, actually our program, Clinical Connections, if you will, it's actually part of a much bigger program called CityLab. CityLab is a biotechnology learning laboratory for middle and high school students at the Boston University School of Medicine and School of Education. We've been around since 1992 and have done various programs for students. Most of the time, students come out to our facility right around what we're down the south end here, where the medical school is, and do any one of several investigations in molecular biology. We're laboratory-based. When we think about how students learn, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later, one of the most effective ways that people learn are to be actively involved in making decisions, in a sense, with that content. And we found that putting students about science education primarily in a laboratory-based experience, and that lab has a broad, certainly a broad definition, if you will, but the idea that students are working with data, they're evaluating data, and they're figuring it out. And so that's what we want students to do, and that's sort of the premise for a lot of what we do in our program. We also have a mobile laboratory that goes out to schools as well, and goes out to the community, not just schools, but the community at large. So with that having been said, let me start off a little bit. This is an overview of our clinical trials program. This is a one-week program for rising high school sophomores and seniors. Right now, as we develop this program, we're in our actually second year of really running this program for students. We want to start off with a high school population. We hope to move to middle school students after that. It's a one-week program. We have several one-week programs during the summer. We have those programs that focus on biotechnology, the basics. They create green fluorescent protein. It sort of models, if you will, drug development. This particular program we thought should focus on clinical trials. We are funded by the National Institutes of Health, the Science Education Partnership Award, and they had a great concern also that students and young people in the community at large be more aware of clinical trials, what they are, and that's a difficult subject, I think. It's not part of the everyday experience of high school students. They might tangentially perhaps encounter those ideas, but it's something that they're not familiar with. They come to our facility. We usually have about 30 or so students per session. We have three labs. Each lab can hold about 15 students. And the instructors consist of our staff. We have graduate students from the School of Public Health that work with us as well. And I think that's important not only from a content perspective to help us, but also from the perspective of talking to these young people and relating to the young people. We have undergraduates from Boston University. I have to say that I am a little bit selfish in that I also am the director of the School of Science Education at the School of Education. We want students, undergraduates also, that are science majors, to get a feel for teaching in the sciences. And we also have high school laboratory assistants, high school students that come back and help us out. So when the students come in, again, we found out that one of the best ways we think, and the research suggests, for students to learn is to figure it out. If I can make an analogy, if we were to ask the coaches, I'll relate to my daughter who's grown now, but when she was playing soccer when she was young, think of it, if we had brought her to the soccer coach at 5 or 6 years old, and the soccer coach said, "Great, we're going to teach you about soccer, but first of all, here's a book about soccer. Here's a video, by the way, you can watch the video. Let's learn the theory of soccer," right? Why not? We have to learn that before we get on the field. You must know the theory and a lot of the skills that you need to know. Then we'll let you get on the field. That would never fly. You know that wouldn't fly. Our theory is, our philosophy is, let's get them on the playing field right away. It might be a little ugly at first. My daughter's team, when they got out there with soccer, looked more like a swarm. But nevertheless, they're out there, and you know what? They learned. She went on to play college soccer. They learn because there's a need. Part of education is fabricating a need for students to learn. In this case, we take that same approach. We need to create a need for the students to figure it out. And so let's get them on the field, if you will. And that field is our laboratory. And you can see that picture on the left are some students that are loading gels, of course. And on the right, they're doing some protein purification. The slide, as you face on the right, is on our mobile laboratory, just to give you a sense of the capacity of that. Now, this is Wendy might have got a little frightened. Well, I hope you can see. That might not have been a good idea. But the reason I put this up like this, a conceptual progression, I could have separated this into several slides. But I want you to get a sense for the pace and flow of the experience. This takes place over a week. You can move a little. No, people don't want to move closer. That never happens. It never happens in church. It never happens in classrooms, right? But in any case, let me tell you a little bit about what the students experience, because we want this to be discovery-based learning. We have two goals here, in a sense. We want the students to certainly learn some science, but our main goal is to have them understand a little bit more deeply the process of clinical trials by being active participants in that. So we have to create a storyline, if you will. I tell my students when they're creating learning experiences, I don't like to call them lesson plans anymore, learning experiences for students or for anyone, I want them to think like they're a producer or a director or a novelist. And they have to create a storyline. And so our storyline goes like this. We've been working for years. One of our main, Mystery of the Crooked Cell, is one of our modules about sickle cell anemia. We chose sickle cell anemia a while ago, back in 92, as one of our disease models, because it's a disease, it lends itself to study for students. It's a point mutation. That point mutation leads to a single amino acid replacement. When it expresses, it actually expresses very clearly on a gel in terms of the protein expression, so students can do some molecular pieces on that. Helps them understand a protein a little bit more. Hemoglobin's been a well-researched protein. We figured, you know, we'd go with our strengths in a sense. So we developed this clinical trials piece based on an understanding of sickle cell anemia. So the first day and a half really involves the students exploring sickle cell anemia. And they do this by teaming up. They get a mystery disease. A patient presents, if you will. We actually have a video of a patient. We don't tell them the name of the disease, although we tell them the name is not important. The real essential question is what's happening inside this person's body, and you need to figure that out. They go through a series of stations, if you will. They discover or put together the pieces to come up with an explanation of the molecular basis, and they discover that hemoglobin is involved in this particular disease. We have them do a gel electrophoresis, and there's a little picture of it up there, but to investigate the properties of hemoglobin, and they find out that it doesn't migrate as quickly, and they compare it to the HBS, sickle cell hemoglobin, to the HbA, or the normal hemoglobin. This time we added a piece, a bioinformatics piece for them. Bioinformatics is not always intuitive. I think for anyone, actually, that's new to it, and it takes a while. But they do. We give them a guideline in which they take a look at the, they go to the protein database and go to the BLAST database for protein and can compare those amino acid sequences, and they recognize that the reason for the behavior of this hemoglobin, the explanation for this lack of a negative charge, if you will, is due to an amino acid replacement. So they get that. They discover it. That's pretty good. But now we still haven't gotten to clinical trials, have we, or a reason for that. So we actually give them a paper that was written in 1978 by Richard Perrine and his daughter, actually, Susan Perrine. Susan is at the School of Medicine now. And they studied sickle cell anemia in Saudi Arabia. Has anybody heard of this, by the way? Anybody familiar with it? Okay, let me tell you a little bit about it, because we give the students it's kind of dense sometimes. You know, it's like you're a high school student, you're reading these clinical papers. I mean, you're not a high school student, and you're reading a journal paper, and you're not familiar with it. It takes a while to work through it. But this has some nice graphs in it, and they can see patterns. And the big deal here is this, part of the storyline, that now that they understand sickle cell anemia a little bit, there has been this case in which people that are homozygous for sickle cell anemia, they seem to be asymptomatic or have very mild symptoms. So what's going on here? And if they look at the data, we grappled with ways to present this. But if they look at the data, they'll recognize that there's another correlation here. A lot of these people have another type of hemoglobin, this mystery hemoglobin, if you will. It turns out to be fetal hemoglobin. So the fetal hemoglobin, they're wondering now, what's up with this? Why would fetal... Any ideas, by the way? I can't help it. I'm a teacher, in a sense. Nobody's going to answer. Nobody likes to answer in these big things. But think about it. Here, they're finding out that these particular individuals that are asymptomatic or mild, have a mild expression of sickle cell anemia, they also have higher than normal percentages of fetal hemoglobin in their system. So we'll put two and two together. Maybe there's something with this fetal hemoglobin that has to do with it. And of course, fetal hemoglobin is the hemoglobin that we all have when we're in the womb, of course. And that fetal hemoglobin has a different affinity, a higher affinity, because it's getting oxygen from a different source across the placenta and so forth. When we're born, that shuts off. That shuts down that gene. And we have the hemoglobin that's expressed that we use. You know, well, preferably it would be HbA. But in any case, in these people with mild symptoms, they have a higher percentage of this fetal hemoglobin. So there's a connection there. I'm going to ask you one question. Given that you know that people with sickle cell anemia who have a higher percentage of fetal hemoglobin in their system, what might that suggest to you as a treatment for sickle cell anemia? Okay, you can talk to each other. You can talk it over. That makes everybody a little nervous. There's a professor at Harvard that has these, never mind. But anyways, he found that one of the lecture methods is to have people, and it works pretty well, turn and speak with each other. It takes a while. It takes a while. We'll get there. So you're waiting for me to give you the answer, huh? Yeah, I know. That's we're conditioned to do that. That's what we're trying to break, that set there with students. But I'll give you a break here. I'll give you a break. I won't force that on you. What was my question again? Thank you. Yeah. See, that's another technique to get people that you did very well to respond. Thank you to help me out there. So found out if that gene for fetal hemoglobin is in all of us, even people with sickle cell anemia, it hasn't gone anywhere. It's just turned off. So if we could somehow turn on that gene in people with sickle cell anemia so they'd express fetal hemoglobin, maybe, just maybe, that would help them out. That would be a way to treat, not cure, but treat sickle cell anemia. So that's our essential question now. Is there a way that we can activate that gene? And that central question, if you will, is an anchor for the rest of the week. They also watched the movie Rare. Rare is a movie that was put out, developed by Stanford University, I believe. It's a true story. It's more of a documentary. Again, I'll ask, if people seen this, about Hermansky Pudlak, I always get that wrong. Hermansky Pudlak disease, syndrome. No? If you get a chance, you can watch it online. It's a true story about an orphan disease in a woman who really went to bat for her daughter and worked with the NIH to try to get clinical trials for this disease. It very much, we have the students watch, it's not about sickle cell anemia, but it very much humanizes clinical trials. I think that one, for myself, learning about clinical trials, I think that sometimes it seems very, distant. I was going to say clinical, but very much distanced or disconnected from humans. It's a lot of, experiments and tests we think about, but this movie does a great job. If you get a chance, you can watch it, you can stream it, I think, online. I highly recommend it. We do this to humanize that for the students, to give them a face, put faces to this idea of clinical trials before we really get into it. And then we move on into the clinical trials piece. We introduce this mock drug, if you will. If you're familiar with there are drugs out there. Oh, wow. See, and I only had 4 slides. You were nervous, huh?
Yeah.
So we'll move along. We introduce the idea that there's a drug. Let's test this drug. The first thing we need to do is find out who's eligible. If people are eligible for this drug, we have them do PCR to test them for the presence of, make sure they're homozygous for sickle cell anemia. Do they really have, there are a lot of different genotypes that can express similar to sickle cell anemia. We also do a restriction digest. That's part of it. Remember, we're laboratory-based. We want the students to do a lot of labs. They tell us overwhelmingly that being involved in this laboratory piece where they actively are involved in working with the data is most meaningful to them. We do an ELISA. We're screening them for HIV. We're kind of inventing some of these labs and applying them to the screening to do a lab, but they're getting the idea. Then we move on to phase one, to look at the safety, we look at ALT to find out in the liver if that is increasing. They do an assay, and they get the data, and they're deciding, is this drug indeed safe or not, or what levels is the drug safe? But rather than tell them about that, they're looking at the data, and they're making the decision about, and they get names of patients, fictional patients, with different vital signs and so forth. And then we go on to phase two, where they actually will test, and this is, I'll finish up right here, they actually will test. They run, we give them the samples, we say these are people that have been treated with the same dose over a period, a longitudinal, a couple of months. They need to run that gel, and they use ImageJ, which is something free online, to analyze those gels, and they get graphs and so forth to find out, it really is a densiometric measure of where they scan the gels, and it's really quite easy, but they use the software to find out, is this drug indeed increasing the level of fetal hemoglobin among the fictional patients? When we're done, I will say that we're still looking at the data on this, but students are telling us, and from we have a poster session at the end, and certainly about half of them that came in when they started, they say a little over, actually it's up closer to about 60 or 70% are saying that, you know, I really learned a lot more about clinical trials. And it's one thing for them to say it, but we go to their poster sessions where we have scientists come in and review them. They are demonstrating this real increase in knowledge. Of course, that's easy to say, right? If you don't know anything about it to begin with, it's no big thing that people know something about it at the end. So what we're really looking at down the road is how do their attitudes change toward clinical trials. So with that, I think I'm done.
All right. Thank you, Dr. You might want to, we have time for one question, if you have one. Otherwise, we can wait till the panel session. Okay. Well, we are running a little bit. Come on up, answer here, the mic.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. I have to say that
most... question.
Oh, the question was, how do we select the students? And I have to say that the students for this pilot, these two pilots we've done, are really self-selected. They choose to come in during the summer. That means they're fairly motivated students. We found in curriculum development, we've done a lot of it for NIAAA, for alcohol and alcohol abuse. We've done, you know, a lot of curriculum development over the years. And it is good to start with students that are somewhat motivated to, first of all, see if it works. Can we teach? Are the students learning? So in a sense, it minimizes some other variables for us. And we certainly will go out when we're starting to go out on our mobile lab and bring it to communities to get a broader population.